95 WBAI.
Fiction is how we organize reality, you know. It's how we make sense of the world around us. And the basic appeal of stories is to explain ourselves to ourselves.
Night shift. shift.
Night shift.
You're listening to Night Shift on WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial.
How long has it been since you've slept?
Since this thing began.
Fiddle this damn thing halfway around the world.
You know, I'm getting pretty sick of you.
Yes, but you love me.
Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
Charles, you're here with us?
I'm very glad to be here.
Charles Quixote Choi.
Yes, indeed.
And the mystery guest, you're back here with us.
Yes, after a long time.
It's been a long time. It's been a long time since any of us have been really... It's been a long time for you. It's been a long time for me, even being here. We've been having shows on tape. Tonight's show is going to be a little interesting because we're going to do the half of it live and then half of it is live on tape. Mm-hmm. Last week's show did not get aired. And they rebroadcast the week before show early. It was a whole thing.
Well, from what I hear, New York's been under some unusual stress lately.
This is the post-Sandy WBAI.
Yeah, okay,
so
right.
All that being said, they did end up running my show at a different time slot someplace else, all you know, without even telling me all that. So that being said, I'm going to run the integral parts of last week this week and have the second part be a night shift special, a film special that I'm going to talk about. In that special, I have an interview with Danny Houston for Hitchcock. Did you see Hitchcock?
No.
All right, I'll talk about that. You didn't see Hitchcock, did you?
No, I couldn't.
I understand.
I mean, no, the last one. You're not talking about Hitchcock in general.
No, but did you see Hitchcock?
Oh, in general?
No,
the last movie, no.
The movie with Anthony Hopkins. Okay, well, I have an interview with Danny Houston, who is the son of John Houston.
Yes, exactly.
And brother of... Angelica Houston. Yes.
Oh, I keep on forgetting that Angelica Houston's related to John Houston.
That's Angelica Houston's John Houston's daughter. Mm-hmm. So that being said, and what? Tell me, do you know something more about Danny Houston?
Well, he's related to so many people. He's half brother with Angelica Houston.
Half brother, that's right. He's there. And what else?
And then his uncle of the actor Jack Houston.
Yes.
Huh? And then stepbrother of writer and editor Allegra Houston.
There it is.
And grandson of the Academy Award winning actor Walter Houston.
There it is. Now, grandson of Walter Houston, who is John Houston's father.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a long legacy of Houston. So I got a chance to interview him about acting, about storytelling, about all that. And do you want to name a few Danny Houston's movies there for those who don't know?
Oh, yes. Maybe the last ones, what do you think?
God, the most popular ones, the most well-known ones.
Well, he was in Robin Hood.
He was, yes.
He was in Robin Hood.
I loved him in... Did you ever see a movie I really like called The Constant Gardener? Did you ever see that?
Yes, yes.
Great film.
Well, yeah, he's a great writer, it goes well to him. Yeah.
Great.
John McCary. Gotta love his stuff.
Yes.
Yes, yeah.
Go ahead.
And then he was in this movie, The Constant Gardener. Do you know
that? We just said that. You were so zoned us out. You didn't hear what we just said.
Did I say The Constant Gardener? I said Robin Hood.
You said Robin Hood, and then we just said The Constant Gardener.
Well, I was reading, sorry. I was reading for all of you.
That's with the laser focus.
He is so
laser focus.
Yes, exactly. The intensity of her attention.
Yeah, I mean, my ears are not multitasking as my other senses.
Most people who are of higher intelligence will tell you there's no such thing as multitasking.
No, but you know, I was also wondering, because I try to remember, you know, sometimes you confuse actors.
Mystery is you're distracting to others in so many different ways. It doesn't surprise me that you distract yourself.
That was
I'm flattered and happy. Thank you. Now I feel better. Okay, so it was in Marie Antoinette. Do we remember which role was he playing in Marie Antoinette? No. I don't remember.
Which version of Marie Antoinette was it?
I believe that's Sofia Coppola, I believe, right?
Sofia Coppola.
Yeah. Kirsten Dunst? Was that the one of Kirsten Dunst?
Yes.
Right.
No, I definitely took a pass on that one. Was it good?
I liked it.
You liked it?
You didn't see it?
No, I did not.
Oh, my God.
I took a pass. I had to.
Oh.
I felt, you know.
He takes a pass on everything I like and love.
That is so funny.
I mean, I always love those kind of movies. He sent me there. That's a good part.
Oh, see, there you go.
Yes, that's a win-win
situation. A win-win situation. There it is.
Yeah.
I know what she likes.
Yeah.
So, Charles? You know who Danny Houston is.
Yeah. No, actually, I had no idea.
Okay, I'll show you a photo of him I took at the junket, which I'll post online. But I do want to say that we're on Facebook right now. You can inbox us or instant message us or however it works there on Facebook. And I was thinking of streaming, but we probably don't have time because we only have like 45 minutes of live show to stream. But I am giving away tickets for, and Maria, you can help us out.
Okay.
And look at that, I just gave away her name. It's the collection. There's a movie coming out called The Collection, which is a new horror film starring people who I cannot read
body parts
in this past. Yes, but it's it looks sort of like a cross between The Human Centipede and Saw. That's what it looks like to me. But The Collection, and there's a screening tomorrow at 7:30. And if you want to go, I will give as many passes as you want. You just email me at Life Is Like Science Fiction. Just put in The Collection, gotta go, and I will send you the passes. You can print them right out.
It does not look like a movie for the squeamish, but there are definitely people who enjoy that kind of
stuff. Definitely not a movie for the squeamish, but I mean, again, if you're a horror movie, and especially like the Joe Masuri fans who are out there, people who like horror movies, who like genre movies, that is definitely the kind of movie. The Collection. So, 7:30 tomorrow, it'll be at the AMC Empire. If you email, you just put in The Collection, and you can look it up, what the movie's about, because all I know is that The Collection is coming out. This is a acapella. Lovely. That's him, dude.
Lovely.
That's his background there. I saw the new documentary, the one that Spike Lee did on...
Oh, yeah.
How was it?
Excellent.
Yeah, yeah.
What a good documentary. He's a great documentary filmmaker, you know.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Because he's such a good storyteller. Mm-hmm. You know, I may not always like the story he's telling.
Yeah.
But he's a very good storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
And for documentary, he gets it. He makes it personal. He keeps it interesting. It's a really good documentary. It's really the making of Bad.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And... it's
which is the wisest thing to take. I mean, because he had a long life, and you know, there are certain parts that you don't necessarily want to focus on unless you want to focus on them.
Well, you know, the thing about it is, it's not a documentary about his life.
Exactly,
it's a documentary about the making of that album,
which is probably the wisest thing to do.
Well, it's I'm sure there are going to be tons of Michael Jackson documentaries over the years,
mm-hmm.
but it's a great thing to do, especially because it's about the music, it's about him doing his art, it's about what made him famous, and what makes him great as an artist, and what he was trying to do, and you know, living in the shadow of his former greatness and all that.
Mm-hmm.
I always think of Rod Serling, you know,
and
achieved his greatest stuff by
the other Night Shift.
Well, the Rod Night Gallery.
That's right.
But anyway, that was, and that still didn't compare to Twilight Zone.
No, by far. I'm actually going through the complete DVDs of the Twilight Zone
really,
right now.
I started. I got about six in.
I'm almost through. I just finished the first season, and I'm trying. You know, there's a lot of good stuff in the second season too. But you know, after a while, it's possible to get Twilight Zoned out.
There it is.
Yeah.
Twilight Zoned out.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen Twilight Zone, Mr. Guest?
No. And
really?
Now I can never say never because he knows that I said I'm not going to watch any James Bond, and then I spent the last week watching the first two and reading the scripts afterwards.
Did you like it?
I watched
Casino Royale.
Yeah.
And Quantum of Solace.
Yeah. But I have to say that reading the script, it wasn't such an intellectual thing.
It is
it's
not.
Just because I didn't understand the whole thing.
Well, you know, there's not much to catch in the scripts, I don't think.
No, I like it.
You know, I would beg to differ as a screenwriter that there are things, you know, it's interesting from a lot. The script is really the blueprint for the film.
I mean, the actors really said a lot that was not said in the script. I thought was excellent. I mean,
for which film are you talking about? Just in general,
the one Casino Royale definitely is the one that comes the most to mind. The interactions between the main characters there—it's just like there's a lot that wasn't said. That was just plain good acting, you know.
So, did you read the script as well?
No, I did not.
So, how do you know that?
Well, I mean, like, I'm watching the
movie. Well, there's direction in script. Script there says, you know, they say things silently. I mean, that can be written in the script. But, you know, it's interesting. We could get into that in a longer show.
Mm-hmm.
But did you like Casino Royale?
I liked Casino Royale quite a bit.
Okay.
I loved it.
You loved it. She loved it. Look at that.
I just said, no, I have to admit that I switched it off after the first 10 minutes, the first time I... But then there was something, you know, in the back of my head said, you have to watch, you have to keep going.
Well,
and then, boom.
Yeah.
But I switched it off. I thought, oh my God, I'm having a headache. What's this? What's this running? What's this jumping?
That's a pre-credit sequence.
Yeah.
And then, you see, it cut me.
And what do you think of Quantum of Solace?
It was less, I mean, I preferred Casino Royale.
That's an understatement.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that, did you see the new one yet?
Yeah.
You didn't
I want to see it so badly. Take me there, Mike.
I would go again.
Yeah.
It's just... I wouldn't quite call it a Bond film. You know what I'm saying? It seems like...
You know, I... It seems like, okay, right. Again, I'm listening. I want to hear what you think.
Like, when it came to John le Carré, there's Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and then there's Smiley's People. And people always forget that there's a book in between those.
That's, okay.
You know, and it's kind of a book where interesting character things happen, but it's not... Kind of, it doesn't have the verb of the things on the other side. And that's kind of what... this felt like to me. You know, it's just like, this is an interesting character piece.
Well, you know, I'll say this for myself.
Which Bond?
Okay, go ahead. I want to hear everything you get to say.
I mean, and it has a lot of grace notes in it. It feels like a film full of grace notes to kind of cleanse the palate for the next spate of Bond films, which is fine, you know. And it's interesting. It's almost like a pastiche of Bond films. you know.
Well, you know,
to a Bond film. Probably.
Okay. I definitely didn't see it that way. I thought actually it was the best of the three, and actually I thought it was the best Bond film, probably in maybe a couple decades.
Yeah.
But that's me, and I'm a big Bond fan.
Well, the critics said that it was the best James Bond ever.
The critics. Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. But anyway, that's what I read. The articles.
Well, and then the critics said.
There's a difference between a good film and a good Bond film.
Well, okay, now again, that's what I was going to get to. To me, there are certain elements I need for a Bond film. And now, were there things that were missing? Did it miss a big mid-film set piece? Yes.
Yeah.
Did it have a large scale, again, even set piece at the end? It didn't quite have all of that. But I thought what you perhaps saw as a weakness, I thought was a strength in that.
I wouldn't call it a weakness.
Okay.
I mean, because I still liked it. I mean, all right, well, there's definitely a strong tonal shift in the last third of the movie. There's a strong tonal, and they hang a lamp on it. They say, all right, we're going to do something that no one's expecting us to do, and they do something that both the antagonist and the audience are not necessarily expecting, and that's fine, you know. And in my view, you know, maybe the movie should have been more of one or more of the other. And I'm not quite sure how I feel about putting them together.
Okay. I can understand that, but we can agree to disagree. Mm-hmm. I thought, for me, that what I thought was strong about the film, what worked for me, was that they've been, since Casino Royale, they've been trying to reboot Bond.
Yeah, yeah.
And rebooting Bond is, to me, okay.
Yeah.
I understand. They have to bring it to a new audience. They have to bring in a new actor playing it. They have to update it. You know, there's a lot of things that needed to happen with Bond to bring it up to, quote-unquote, today.
Yeah.
So I felt that this, you know, Quantum of Solace to me was like a complete misfire. And from what I also understand, they had planned, because you saw Quantum of Solace picked up right after Casino Royale, and they had planned for the new one to pick right up after Quantum of Solace.
Right.
But they abandoned, and everything that was shot for the beginning of this movie was abandoned. They went a different direction. And I think the best thing they did here was bring back the elements that you want in a Bond movie.
Right.
Everything from, you know, Q and Moneypenny and over-the-top villain. And there are certain things that you enjoy. Part of what makes a Bond movie, there are a few factors that have to be in a Bond movie
to me
for it to be a Bond movie.
Yeah.
And those things were missing completely in the last film.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, in the first film, I'll allow that because they're trying to reboot it.
Well, all right, you know, there seem to be two types of Bond movies that I like. Either, is it Never Say Never? Or is it You Only Live Twice? The one with the volcano and the ninjas.
You Only Live Twice.
Yeah, You Only Live Twice. It can go completely, like, over the top. And that's the Bond that I grew up.
Okay.
Or you can go Casino Royale, nitty gritty.
Okay, well, now you see, now you're talking about something in the Bond cycle.
Yeah.
They call it the purge and the bloat.
Well, see, that's what...
The bloat is for the Connerys, was You Only Live Twice.
Yeah, see, but that's the thing of it. Skyfall is a mix of those two movies.
Well, you see, what I thought worked about it, that it was a mix of those two things, in that it was a strong character piece, okay, but it was still Bond. Bond was still Bond. Mm-hmm. You know, he did a lot of the things I've been waiting for him to do that made him Bond.
Yeah.
I like that he was tough in everything that they had in Casino and Quantum, but he had no sophistication.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of who Bond was, too.
Bond
could, you know, tell you what year the wine was, you know, or the year of the liquor or whatever, and was aware of, and had a great tailor, and was aware of all the finer things in life, and had been educated that way to pass for, you know, a British gentleman, as it were.
Right.
That was all missing. I thought, to me, a good Bond movie has to have a good spy story to it.
Yeah.
And I thought this was a pretty decent spy story.
Yeah.
Especially that, you know, it took places in, and again, you said that tonal shift. I like that it went there, but it didn't quite go there as much as you wanted.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah,
and yeah. And the big set piece was more an emotional set piece,
yes,
than an action set piece.
Right, right, right.
And again,
right.
I understand that, and I understand why they did that. And I think with the Bond movies, you know, you have to experiment to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I thought Pierce Brosnan did some interesting things with the Bond character.
Yeah, I think he just got bad scripts and bad directors.
He did. And by the time he got the role down, he was getting too old.
Yeah, exactly.
So, and I kind of think Daniel Craig, I like him.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, eventually going to call him Daniel Craig because he's going to crag out a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bond needs to have that.
Who was the best?
Well, there's no question of who the best was. See,
there's no question.
You're growing up. You're growing
Sean
up.
There's a reason why. The movie takes place in Scotland.
He's a legend.
Too.
We all
the
know.
Best. All right, you haven't seen any of those. I have to.
Well, I heard from my parents that he was the best.
He was. Your parents knew. So, anyway, I say all that to say that I did like it a lot. I thought it was the first time it really felt like a Bond movie.
Okay.
And that pastiche that you're talking about, I thought it was very smart and in some ways comforting for them to pay homage to the old Bonds and to use the music in the way they did and again, I agree, yes, they recycled elements.
There's nothing wrong with that.
And they're probably going to be doing it with the new Star Trek movies too, you know.
Yeah.
And I think if you grew up and you know the original, by the time, you know, it's 50 years, by the time you're seeing the new ones, they have to be repeating themselves.
Right.
You know what I mean? Even a TV series, after a while, like, I don't know how Dallas lasted 14 years.
Well, it always depends on what you repeat.
I agree.
And that's, kind of my problem with the current spate of Star Trek movies, but it's not even their fault because it's...
Spate? There's only one.
Well, there's going to be another one, right?
Okay.
And it's not the director or the writer or the...
But you're just specifically talking about the last Star Trek.
Yes.
Okay, I'm with you.
I mean, because to be a movie, it has to be kind of action-y. Well, for the most part, right? I mean, when you're dealing with a huge property like Star Trek, it has to be kind of action-packed. And Star Trek is not quite that. Star Trek is always at its best.
So you didn't like the Star Trek?
I liked it. Yeah. I mean, but the more I think about it, the more I'd also like traditional values exploration Star Trek.
Well, you see, I mean, the premise of Star Trek and what Star Trek got into are not necessarily two different things, but they can be sometimes because the exploration was more... Next Generation did a lot more of that.
Yeah.
Whereas Star Trek, the original series, had a lot more action.
Yeah.
And speaking of Star Trek Next Generation, which is a good segue, there is an event, and I'm going to be giving out tickets, and you got to pay close attention. I'll announce this later in the show, but you got to pay close attention. There is a special screening. Star Trek The Next Generation is coming out. The second season is coming out on Blu-ray, and they've remastered all of it. Were you a Next Gen fan?
Yeah.
All right, well, when you see them, they're pretty amazing. The first set of Blu-rays is amazing. But what they're doing in celebration of this coming out, this remaster and everything, they're releasing two episodes on the big screen.
Which ones?
One called Measure of a Man. And Measure of Man, which is the most famous episode from season two, I think it was one nominated for the Emmy.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's one when he gets put on trial?
I believe so.
Right.
And they added 13 minutes that had been cut out.
Wow, really?
So you're going to see it on the big screen. It says this Thursday. Now, I have passes. I have pairs of passes for different areas around the city. So depending on where you live, I can hook you up. And you got to email me right away. If not now, in the morning, because I got to mail these out tomorrow for you to get them in time.
All
okay? Because this Thursday, it's 7 o'clock. Okay, I have in Manhattan, I have for Union Square. In Queens, I have six pairs. Okay, in Queens, Flushing. And Flushing, Queens. If you're in Flushing.
Grew up there.
Yep. And I also have, as a matter of fact, is it six pairs for Flushing? Yes, it is. It is six, two, four, six. Six pairs for Flushing. I have, and so in the heading, just put Star Trek Flushing, Star Trek. I have Secaucus, New Jersey. Star Trek Secaucus. I have four pairs for Secaucus. I have Westbury, New York. I have four pairs for Westbury. So just put in Star Trek Westbury. And, of course, in the email, put your address. Your name, address. I will send you a confirmation saying tickets are on their way. And you'll be ready to go that evening. And I also have the Empire 25, the IMAX, at the Empire 25 on 42nd Street. And I have Kips Bay, which is on 32nd and 2nd. And then I have another pair for New Rochelle. So there it is. Kips Bay,
ooh.
Westbury, Flushing, 42nd Street, Union Square. Just put Star Trek if you want to go. Now, you email me at lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com. That's lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com. I got to get these out tomorrow morning, so you got to let me know. So there it is. Now, the collector, all you have to do is email me, and I'll email you the pass, and you can print it out. There it is. Bring your whole office. So, I've gotten all that out of the way. In the beginning of the show, did you notice I had a quote there? Mr. Guest?
Which quote?
I had a quote. I had someone saying what storytelling is. Did you catch that?
Nope.
Did you catch it?
No, I did not.
You didn't catch it. All right, I'm gonna let you hear it again. But anyway, that quote is from the director of the writer-director of Killing Them Softly.
All right, right.
And his name is Andrew Dominique. Uh-huh. And what's interesting is he also did a film with Brad Pitt called The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward James Ford.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And,
right, right.
And it's a film that didn't do very well, but from, you know, I've heard a lot of good things about it.
Yeah, I'm more familiar with the Yogi Berra spoof of that.
What's the Yogi Berra spoof?
Yogi. They did this version of the Yogi. Of the ending of that movie. Only it's Yogi Bear with Boo Boo. You know, and Yogi Bear is.
Who did this?
Just some guys, and it's beautifully shot. It's absolutely beautifully shot. And in the end, Yogi gets shot in the back of the head, and it's just...
It's kind of funny.
It is really funny. And it's set completely, apparently, like the ending of the movie. The music's the same, you know. And Boo Boo picks up the shotgun.
And Boo Boo shoots him. That's kind of funny. You know, why can I not hear two channels? What are you guys hearing? I only hear one channel.
Mm, yeah.
I only hear one channel. All right, so...
By the way, Q-Who is the episode where Q introduces the Federation to the Borg. Well, I'm sorry, the Enterprise to the Borg.
That's the Borg episode.
That's the first Borg episode.
The first Borg episode. Okay, well, there it is.
Yeah.
You see, I never got to watch Star Trek Next Generation when it was on. I watched the first episode and I never watched it
again. Oh, well, yeah. All right. I can see that.
I was, you know, I stopped watching TV by then. And I missed... I always watched the first episode. I saw the first episode of Voyager. I saw the first episode of
Voyager.
Enterprise. But then I never watched another one. I saw the first episode of DS9.
DS9
was a good show, though. You know, I've gone back and seen some on DVD. It was a good show. Some people say it was the best Trek.
I liked when Enterprise, when Next Generation was good, it was very good, but there was a lot of miss, especially in that first season.
Well, from what I understand, it didn't start really getting good till second, third season. That's what I've heard.
Definitely.
And, but that's true of many series.
Yeah.
Many series, they got to kind of get their feet wet. I heard Babylon 5 was like that, too.
I'm a huge Babylon 5 fan, but it didn't really. Well, there's some excellent episodes in that first season, but. There are definitely episodes where the executive producer, J. Michael Straczynski, have said, I can't win them all.
I got you.
Yeah.
Well, I like Michael Straczynski. He wrote that Clint Eastwood film, the one with Angelina Jolie.
Yeah.
And do you know the film I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Angelina Jolie?
Yeah, real, based on...
Angelina Jolie, I don't know the movie.
It was the one where...
The Changeling.
I know that movie then.
He wrote that.
Yeah.
So, you have no idea what we're talking about, Babylon 5, Star Trek, none of that.
No, guys, you can go on.
Deep into the... And is anybody talking to us on the Facebook?
No.
No one's talking to us? How do you talk to us?
We're talking classic geek fodder. You think they'd be all over us on Facebook.
All right, I'm going to play the Dominique quote just to say that I thought it was a really interesting quote, and I thought he gave some very interesting answers to. You know, I always ask certain questions of directors. I always ask them, you know, how they be, you know, when they first knew they wanted to be storytellers and what they think makes a good story and a story worth telling. And he had something very interesting to say. I'll let you hear what he had to say.
Fiction is how we organize reality, you know. It's how we make sense of the world around us. And the basic appeal of stories is to explain ourselves to ourselves.
I thought that was pretty good.
That's a pretty good one.
Later on, when you guys who are out there in listening world, I have an interview with Dave McGee, who is the screenwriter for Life of Pi. Did you?
Oh yeah. I just took my nephews and my parents.
What did you think? Did you like it?
I liked it. I did like it. I think it started off a little slow, to be honest. Mm. But I overall liked it. I especially liked the ending.
I did too. And there's also a movie coming out this weekend, this Friday, with Robert Carlyle called California Solo, which is an interesting film about a former rock star who is no longer a rock star, and he kind of works at an organic farm,
right.
At a farmer's market in the city, and is a young girl who's kind of, about the biggest bright spot in his life.
Right.
Because he's kind of hiding out. Right. And then he kind of gets in trouble with immigration because he's from England.
Right.
It's very good.
It sounds like a part that was made for him almost.
Oh, he wrote it. He literally wrote it for him. Yes, he did. The writer director says that in the interview.
Right.
He says he wrote it for him. So I have an interview with Marshall Louis for California Solo later. And you are tuned to listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI 99.5 FM. This is Night Shift. And the mystery guest has a story for us.
The Swedish woman charged for sexual activities with skeleton.
Yes. Okay. I'd like to know. What's that all about?
Wow, that's Stockholm.
Okay, talk to
me. Stockholm, a woman in Sweden has been charged with engaging in sexual activities with a human skeleton and could face jail time for disturbing the peace of the dead, a Swedish prosecutor said.
Disturbing the peace of the dead. Okay, go ahead.
Police found a full human skeleton, skulls, and a box containing other human bones by chance after responding to a call saying a shot had been fired from her flat in the city of Gothenburg.
Now pause for a sec. I'm just trying to imagine how you get caught having sex with a skeleton.
I'm just, all right.
All right. She's going to tell us the story, but I'm trying to figure that out before she...
No. So, I mean, this is how great an introduction for Suri is. The woman was having sex with a skeleton. And then suddenly a shot rang out.
Exactly. All right, go ahead, please.
So they also discovered CD-ROMs titled My Necrophilia and My First Experience and photographs of the woman engaging in various sexual activities with a skeleton.
She took photos?
Well,
she
did. I mean, how many times is she going to do it, right?
It said the woman...
Well, how do you know they're not just simulated?
Well,
simulated.
It has to be all simulated.
I could get her off of that. Go ahead.
She must have confessed.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it said the document said the woman had handled the bones in a shameful and unethical manner.
Handled the bones in a shameful manner.
She's interested in the dead, prosecutor Christina Staffas told Reuters. She has pictures of morgues, churches, and graveyards. The 37-year-old woman, unemployed, has also been accused of selling human bones to an artist in Uppsala in eastern Sweden this past summer.
So it's illegal to sell them, or what about to buy them? How come the artist is not in jail? Go ahead.
Well, it's like drugs, right?
The woman has said she bought the bones. She bought them, which were around 50 years old or more and from different parts of the world, over the internet for historical purposes, and says that it's not her in the photographs. Her trial will take place next week.
Not her in the photographs.
Is that the fact that she...
You want to know how much...
Go ahead.
No, she faces a maximum 2 years in prison.
2 years in prison for having sex with for having photos of you having sex with a skeleton.
Well, crazy.
She sounds like a David Lynch character.
You know?
Yeah, in Sweden.
I mean,
morbid is Sweden to me? It's a morbid country. I'm sorry, Swedish people around.
If she paid for the skeleton, does that make that prostitution as well? Or
The thing. Like, you stick a little $5 bill in the.
I mean, men play with a doll. Women can play with skeletons, right?
I would normally agree, but there's just not that much, I mean, substance to a skeleton. I mean, that's the entire point, right? I mean, it seems. I mean, I give her credit for creativity. I mean, but it just seems physically difficult to have sex with a skeleton.
You know, I don't even want to. Picture
this. I'm completely picturing it right now.
I don't want to picture the difficulties, and I'm just saying, like, what do you do with what? That's what I want to know. Like,
it doesn't say that the article doesn't say.
And she's a woman, so I don't want to know.
You can play with your own creativity.
I don't want to know.
There's an obvious joke here that I don't think I can say on here.
Yes, no. Yes, she was getting boned.
Yes. Thank you. All right, thank you.
That's what you want to say. I know that's what you want to say. So, all right, and you have a story, Charles? Charles?
Well, that's a tough act to follow.
Yes, it is.
You know what? I'm going to go with the Kung Fu Nuns Teach Cosmic Energy to Certain Scientists.
Oh, let's just hear that title again.
Kung Fu Nuns Teach Cosmic Energy to Certain Scientists.
Kung Fu Nuns.
Kung Fu
Nuns. Teach Cosmic Energy to CERN scientists.
Exactly.
Yes.
You gotta love that.
Okay, I'm with that. Did you understand that one, Mr. Guest?
No.
Okay, come on. You don't know anything about Kung Fu Nuns?
No, I think I haven't met them yet. Okay. I wish.
I've met Kung Fu Nuns.
I'm sure they have a lot to teach.
Well, you know.
Yes, they clearly do.
Well, the martial art Wing Chun was famously founded with the help of a Kung Fu Nun from Shaolin Temple.
Kung Fu Nun.
Yes.
Okay, I'm with that. All right, go ahead. Talk to me.
Well, so these are Tibetan Buddhist nuns, and Tibetan Buddhists aren't known for Kung Fu. You know, but these nuns learned it from their comrades in Vietnam. And so they're studying some esoteric Vietnamese martial arts. But because they're Buddhists and because they're nuns, they, of course, learn Shaolin Kung Fu as well. Yeah, I mean, because it's just, you know, part of the course. Damn right. So these Himalayan nuns struck poses of hand chops, high kicks, and punches while touring CERN, where we were trying to unlock the secrets of the universe.
You always need to bring a bevy of Kung Fu nuns to unlock the secrets of the universe.
Yeah.
That's what I say.
You're smashing particles and you're smashing heads.
There it is.
Absolutely.
For God.
Yes.
There for it God. Is.
Well, Nirvana. Emptiness. Nirvana.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes.
Well, you know.
For a higher power.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, like.
For a higher power.
Yeah. I mean, the scientists at CERN are trying to find out the secrets of the void, and so are the Buddhist nuns. So there you go.
There it is.
Uh-huh.
Sounds very mystic.
It does. I mean, you know, Kung Fu nuns.
Yeah.
I know you have another story, Mr. Guest.
I have another one related because it's about the Vatican. Carpe Twitter.
Yeah, now let me just ask you a question here.
Yes.
Because now the Vatican is twittering.
Uh-oh.
So here's my question. Growing up in Italy, what is the perception of the Vatican? How powerful are they?
Oh, yeah.
Are they respected, resented, revered? What's the deal?
They were respected very much. I remember in my childhood, the Pope was John II, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was very respected.
Was that John Paul II?
Same. And then, but no, lately, not that much. There are many problems inside the Vatican's new scandals.
So, like in Italy, you're hearing about scandals all the time.
Lately, there are a few, and the new Pope is not liked.
Mm.
Anyway, Ratzinger is not liked as the previous one. The previous one had some charm, even if I'm not that religious, I have to say, I have to admit, that he was a very charismatic figure, but not this one. But this is a, you know, it's an accident. It's not that every pop was charismatic.
Okay, all right,
but
so...
it's regardless of religion, you know, it's about the personality.
All right, so Pope tweets.
Pope tweets, not, well, the Vatican, I don't think that the Pope is himself.
The Pope, I'd want to picture the Pope on his BlackBerry.
No, I don't think he is. I mean, I wouldn't be so surprised to hear this guy, but anyway. Sorry, I didn't say anything. carpet tweeter.
You, as an Italian, called.
I shouldn't
weird,
say that.
You are going to burn.
Oh my God! Is it a blasphemy? Say it. Say
it
to
is
me.
Blasphemy.
It is very.
It must be.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. So who do you?
Shall I apologize in
no,
the, on
no,
air?
No. It's too late.
Okay.
Yeah,
anyway,
you're going to burn in hell.
I didn't say anything. Did I say anything? No. I just said that the Vatican tweets on you Latin accent.
Italian hell. Like, that of olive oil.
It's a nice, yes, it's okay. A nice one. They tell him now. Okay, so carpe tweeter. Vatican tweets on new Latin academy. Academy. So a senior Vatican cardinal, so it's a cardinal, tweeted in Latin on Wednesday to urge people to attend the inauguration of...
To urge.
To attend the inauguration...
You said to urge. Urge.
Thank you.
Okay.
To urge people to attend the inauguration of, you guessed it, the Holy See's new Academy for Latin Studies.
Mm.
This is Latin. I'm good in Latin, I studied. So, odie una cum Ivano Dionigi novam aperiemus Academiam Pontificiam Latinatis et Benedicto conditam. Hora, via conciliationis.
Now, what does all that mean?
Please. Was the tweet by Cardinal Ravasi. So it says, today at 5 p.m., along with Ivano Dionigi, we will open the new
Pontifical
Academy for Latin Studies, founded by Benedict, Via della Conciliazione. It's an important street in Rome. It was not the first tweet in Latin. An Italian professor has been doing it for some time. But evidently, Ravasi wanted to seize the day. Seize the day, or carpe diem.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope earlier this month announced that he had instituted the Pontifical Academy for Latin Studies, placing it under the auspices of the Vatican's Ministry for Culture. Dionigi, a Latin scholar, who is rector of Bologna University. I'm sorry, that was the university where I studied.
You went to Bologna?
Yes, I was at Bologna University, which is actually one of the best. And it's the second ancient in the whole Europe. Okay, I said it.
You know, you realize...
I'm very proud
Bologna
to have studied
there. Bologna has negative connotations in America.
Why? Bologna?
You say you're full of bologna.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yes.
It's a
colloquialism. It means like you're full of crap.
Yeah, but Bologna, because it's connected to the food.
Yeah, because bologna is full of crap.
Right. Bologna is just a mixture.
It's literally full of like.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Bologna is for us. It's very nice. It's three ingredients. It's not crap. It's not so much meat.
American bologna.
Yeah, American bologna.
Okay.
Is bologna.
Okay.
All right,
so
but
Okay, so Dionigi, a Latin scholar who's rector of Bologna University, widely recognized to be the world's oldest, is the Academy's first president. The Pope started the Academy to promote the study and use of Latin in the Roman Catholic Church and beyond. When instituting the Academy, the Pope said Latin, which is still the official language of the Universal Church, was the subject of renewed interest around the world, and the Academy was mandated to encourage further growth. Oh my goodness, Latin again.
It is.
So why not know Greek also?
I have a Greek story too.
Please.
There you go.
Well, you, Charles, you had another story for us?
Well, I think one should follow that with a British man giving cocaine to trick-or-treaters by mistake.
Yeah, please. Now, how does that happen?
Well, I'm kind of confused because I didn't know the British practiced Halloween and had trick-or-treating in the first place. But I guess, you know...
But they don't practice Thanksgiving.
Yes. And every time of the year is, you know, good to give away cocaine to children.
exactly.
So you had three primary school-age children in one English city, basically emptied their trick-or-treat goodie bags and found several bags of cocaine. The man who mistakenly...
Dad was like, give me that.
Yeah, exactly. He mistakenly handed out his cocaine stash to the kiddies instead of candy, and he was given a community service sentence in court.
Community service sentence? And the woman having sex gets 2 years?
Personally, I can
I'm
see-
sorry. You can have sex with as many skeletons as you want.
All right.
I really would not put you in jail for that. But if you give cocaine to children by accident, I'd say you could use a little filter. What do you think?
Oh, it's horrible.
Okay.
I mean, like, I just find this unbelievable, mostly because this sounded more like something that you'd expect a pot smoker to do.
Exactly. Hey, dear little dudes, here's some candy. You know, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe he felt invincible and you know, therefore thought it was, like, you know, like, appropriate to give away, you know, cocaine.
Wait, didn't you say it was an accident?
Yeah, it was an accident. So, this doesn't make any sense to me. So...
He had the cocaine by accident.
Accidentally had some cocaine.
That was flour, sugar. Oh my God.
It was an accident.
Does it really get you?
The man in question...
Not only did I accidentally give it to the children, but I accidentally had it, too.
The man in question is an apprentice panel beater, whatever the hell that is.
An apprentice panel beater. Well, he's not even a full panel beater yet.
Yeah. What is a panel beater? Named Donald Jr. Green, and he fished in his pockets.
Donald Jr. Green.
God, he fished in his pockets for a bag of chewy sweets.
Was it during the trial?
No, this is...
You mean when they came to the door?
I was
unprepared, Your Honor. I was wearing my Coke pants.
He was digging in his pants to give children candy to children? Oh, God, I wouldn't want any of that candy.
Listen, I would have taught my child, like, look, if they don't have it out, don't take it.
You know, I'm beginning to understand why the British don't practice Halloween. They just do it wrong.
But do you say here to kids, don't accept candies from people?
Well, first of all, you go with them. Hello, you know? At least they emptied it out before they brought it back to their room and just started digging in.
No, but I mean, that was one of the first things I heard from my mother. Don't accept candies.
This story gets better.
They have Halloween...
No.
Italy, I was just.
In general, if there is someone who does.
But once a year, you do take candy from a stranger.
So
the whole concept of Halloween is getting candy.
It's true.
So this story just gets better. So he pulls out a plastic bag containing 8 bags of cocaine that he had bought for £200, about $320, and he dropped off the goodie bags, you know, carried by the 3 children aged 8, 6, and 5. Who were out trick-or-treating, escorted by their father, an off-duty policeman.
Stop! Really?
Yes.
Wow, that's some karma.
Oh, that's a major karma.
Wow.
Yeah. So, a 12-month community sentence. Ordered to do 130 hours of community work and ordered to pay court costs totaling £145. Wow, that seems like a good time to live in.
Wow.
If you're going to live, you know, I mean, in a if you're going to do coke in any town in Britain, that seems like the one to go to.
I'd say...
That's pretty lenient.
Where is it based again?
The mystery guest is intrigued.
Yeah.
What street was this that they're giving out cocaine?
I mean, had the one from Vatican in Sweden. I'm curious, what's this?
So this is Oldham. Oldham in Britain, in Northern England.
Northern England. Because I might go there.
Oh, I see.
South.
Trick or treat.
Well, you are tuned to listen to Sponsored Radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM. I did want you to cover this story, too, Charles. And did you have another story, Mr. Guest?
No.
I have another one for you, but here. Because I wanted your thoughts on just that, the whole GM crop thing. But I am curious now, what in your opinion... Mr. Guest, what's the difference between a when you've crossed the line and a fetish?
Oh, huh,
you
hard.
Know what I mean,
hard
because you know she's boning with her bones, and you know, but she's disturbing the dead, they say, because she says she bought it online, which brings up a whole bunch of other questions. But what's your thought?
Yeah, but it's also funny because Sweden is not that Catholic. It's not such a Catholic country. So I don't want to imagine what would happen in Italy if they would find out something like that. No, it's not about that. I'm not the one who, you know, I don't know who can really judge what's the hedge.
I just want your opinion.
my opinion, it's hard to say. I mean, of course, to me, this woman, she's not well, but it's not that she has to
you
go to jail.
Jail time? Yeah.
No, never. Of course, not jail, but she's not someone who's well at the same time. No, what do you think? Is she well?
I'd say she's clearly not well.
Yes, but not enough to go to jail, of course.
Not if this other guy can give out cocaine to kids. And what's your thought there, Charles, about fetish? Is there a line you think that crosses between fetish and obsession / psychotic?
Well, can you really call it disturbing the dead if the skeleton very clearly has a smile on its face?
Stop. No, be nice.
Sorry. I'm sorry. Well, it's so much easier to talk about when you're not dealing with human remains. If you're dealing with, say, a machine or even, say, an animal, I think people are generally less sensitive. Well, maybe the animal rights people might be a bit more icked out by...
Icked out.
Seriously, icked out. But yeah, I mean, when you're dealing with human remains, I've dug my ruins, for instance, and we're very sensitive when it comes to human burials. Not the least of which because we're digging on someone else's land with someone else's ancestors.
Okay.
So I think that's a tricky question. Ethically speaking, I mean.
That's why we want to take some calls. We at least have Chris.
Is Chris around?
Yeah, well, the phones don't work here, so we can't really.
Well,
we called him, he couldn't hear really you. He could hear me.
He couldn't hear you guys.
You know,
people donate the body to science, right?
That's true. I had a friend who just did that.
Would you donate your body to sexiness?
No.
Would I feel my bones were desecrated?
But you'd be able to get some even after you were dead.
That's perhaps true.
Hello?
Chris. I have a question for you. What do you think there's a line that you cross between fetish and becoming obsessed?
This corpse is getting more action than I am.
Stop. Now be nice. But she's unemployed. What's your thought there? Is there a line to be crossed between something becomes a fetish and then like there's something wrong with you?
Explain that just a little further.
Okay. Like a fetish. People have a fetish, a foot fetish, or whatever.
You mean like feet? I want to smell the dirty feet?
That could be your fetish.
I remember having this conversation with somebody in a store.
In a store. What kind of store?
Oh, it's a comic book store.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And this guy...
Like a shoe store.
No. This guy said that he had a foot fetish.
So you can touch his feet. What?
This guy said he had a foot fetish.
I was just like,
yeah.
No. Yeah. Charles is telling a story. You can't hear him. See?
Oh.
He's telling a story about a foot fetish. Are you listening on the radio?
Well, I was listening, and
then you turned it off because you weren't on.
She
was like, "I was listening." Now, because you can't really hear us, that's why we just called you for this one question.
Oh, you just called me for the one question.
Yes.
You see how it is? You see how I'm just a little. What am I?
I feel for you.
Where am I? That was from a movie. Almost Famous. Take the laundry. That's what I am. Take the laundry. Yeah, I was listening. The show is really, is really good. I think the Vatican is the Vatican, and I answered that question. What it was like to go to the Vatican? She went to the Vatican.
You went to the Vatican?
Everybody has to go to the Vatican in Italy. It's
like,
mandatory.
It's like going to the Statue of Liberty here.
You have to go.
Yeah.
I understand.
I mean, it's beautiful.
The opinion of Next Generation, and he's so right on, man. I mean,
right. I mean,
look at Charles. Charles, like, yeah, right. I'm right on, right?
I always agree with people who agree with me.
He says he always agrees with people who agree with him.
You haven't seen any Next Generation?
No. All right. Well, here's the thing. I shared this a little later in the show because we have to go to tape in a minute. But I never watched Next Generation when it was on TV. But then that year, when Next Generation was about to come out with the movies, the Museum of Television and Radio here in New York was playing them. Mm-hmm. Okay, they were playing all the classic, most important, you know, Worf and the Borg.
Did
and
you
all
see
that
one with the flute?
With the flute? I don't know. Because they showed about 12 episodes, and I saw them all on the big screen.
Right.
And those are the only 12 I had seen at that point. So I saw, like, I've seen maybe 15 Next Generation episodes.
There's one that won the Hugo that completely deserved it.
Yeah.
That you have to watch. Well, it's by far the best episode of Next Generation.
Yes. Yeah, Chris, Charles says the best episode is this one with the flute.
Like, yes, the one with the flute is interesting because you really to go in the direction that it goes. And it's it makes you contemplate your concept of how you view life and how you want to live your life. And it's almost like It's a Wonderful Life meets the flute meets Next Generation. Right, Charles?
Yeah, that's a good way of, it makes you re-examine a lot. You know, it sheds a really interesting light on all the characters. But, you know, it's a really good human story. It's hard to describe it.
He says it's a good human story. Well, Chris, we're going to go to tape, but I wanted to get you in there. You anything you want to share with us before you go?
Oh, you know, just, you know, I just hope that, you know, all the powers that be, that BAI can get back on its feet, that, you know, a catastrophe happened to the building and, you know, it has put us into some kind of time weird situation, warp, that hopefully, you know, that everybody, you know, can, you know, things can get back to what they once were. But it just goes to show you how important this station is. I guess people, you know, it's great that you're on. It's great that Charles is there and Mr. Guest and that, you know, and then I can, you know, that we can actually broadcast. I mean, that's just a great, great thing. And it goes back to the emphasis that how important BAI is and the ability that we are able to do what we do when we can do it.
Well, there it is. Until next week, Chris, hopefully we'll have the phones back and everything. And you keep listening, and you can like us on Facebook at NITESHIFT on Facebook. And you can, you know, sign up to our, what do they call it when you sign up to Twitter? You can follow us on Twitter. Yes, sorry. Had a little this moment there. I had a pre 21st century moment. You can follow us on Twitter, NITESHIFTZ. Night Shift. And there it is. Chris?
Yes.
I will call you off air.
You have to get into some kind of a fetish, though, man. Get back to do you have any kind of fetish? I mean, seriously. Well, leave me real quick, but just give everyone just that taste of what kind of fetish you like. I know what you like. I know what it is. You don't want to share.
We will hold that information in
your fetish. You want to share it.
Thank you.
Peanut butter.
Chunky or smooth?
I don't get the peanut butter thing.
Have you ever seen Mike with a bottle of Jiffy, right?
Is that the fetish of him?
Jiffy peanut butter, be careful, man.
This is his thing.
Okay, thank you for the warning.
Until next week.
Always good to hear you, Chris.
Thank you, Charles. Charles, you're on your way to Turkey. Charles is on his way to Turkey for 2 weeks.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Have you ever been to Turkey?
No. First time.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we got to have him come back when he's back.
Well, how long are you going to be there for?
2 weeks.
2 weeks. Can you hear him?
And what's like the most incredible thing that you're supposed to see there when you go to Turkey? What's the incredible thing?
It's probably going to be the Hagia Sophia, but I'm really looking forward to seeing Troy.
There it is. Troy. He's looking forward to seeing Troy.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, be careful.
Yeah.
You are tuned to listener-sponsored radio WBAI, and this is Night Shift. welcome to a Night Shift movie special. I have a lot of music, interviews, reviews, and even some giveaways for you. So please, stay tuned. Herman is probably most famous for the work he did with Alfred Hitchcock. They made many films together, and the scores for those films are as indelible as the plots and scenes we remember and imagery from those films. The music is equally important. And though Bernard Herrmann did many, many other numerous and memorable scores, like Taxi Driver, Day the Earth Stood Still, It's Alive, and films like that, he's most remembered for the work he did with Alfred Hitchcock. And as you probably know, there's a new movie that came out this past Friday
about Hitchcock
called Hitchcock. And it stars Anthony Hopkins as Hitchcock and Helen Mirren as his wife, Alma. It also stars Scarlett Johansson, Toni Collette, Danny Houston, and Jessica Biel, and a really great cast of character actors. And the whole film takes place during the filming of Hitchcock's most memorable film, which is Psycho. What's interesting about the film from a film perspective is you get to find out all that was going on behind the scenes making what is now the seminal film, or the seminal horror film. You have to understand, at the time when Psycho was made, horror films were not anything that any director of any stature would do. And for the most part, most horror movies were in the genre of supernatural. And this, not only did it take the genre to another level, both with its use of music and its artistic approach and the subversive nature of telling the story that kind of sets you up for something, and killing off the main character in the first 10, 15 minutes of the film, but every horror movie, I think, since 1960 owes something to Psycho, because it changed the game. When you see the film, there are so many elements that, and what I'm talking about now, Psycho. When you see Psycho, there are so many elements that have been repeated, regurgitated, redone, that if you've never seen Psycho and you see it, you probably will guess what's going to happen, only because the film's been ripped off so much. In Hitchcock, the one thing that you takes a few minutes to get used to is Anthony Hopkins as Hitchcock. He doesn't so much do an imitation of Hitchcock, but he does, I guess what you'd say, Anthony Hopkins doing Hitchcock, and you get used to him very quickly. It's a very fascinating and interesting look behind the scenes of not just filmmaking, but the industry at the time, what was going on with the censors, what he had to do, and it's based on a book, Alfred Hitchcock and the Making of Psycho by Stephen Rebello. It's produced by a number of big-name Hollywood producers, and it's been one of those screenplays that has been, you know, the greatest unproduced screenplay for many, many years, because the original book came out in the early 80s. So seeing this film now and it finally getting there, there are a number of things that come to bear. And I say, if you love Hitchcock, it's clearly a must-see. There have been some feedback and some backlash that I've read about people who knew Hitchcock and don't feel that this and the other film that's on cable called The Girl, which also is about Hitchcock, but about his relationship with Tippi Hedren during the making of The Birds and Marnie, is that he's played or portrayed in these films as somewhat neurotic and somewhat, let's just say conflicted. And people who knew him say he wasn't quite like that. Well, I say when you see this film, you'll believe that a good deal of it is true. I had the chance to speak to some of the actors in the film and the director, and most specifically got a chance to sit with Danny Houston, who plays sort of a friend of Hitchcock's wife, Alma, and a potential lover of hers as well, and much to the chagrin of Alfred Hitchcock. But the thing about this movie that will really, really stay with you is just what a risk he took to make this film. Now, without giving away too much about the movie, it, for any artist, the whole notion of going out on a limb and the whole notion of wanting to reinvent yourself, even if you've been successful, even if people want to see you keep doing the same thing, will definitely resonate. I think it'll resonate for anybody who pursues anything and has to be true to themselves, or is in danger of not being true to themselves, i.e. selling out or anything like it. It's a really great film, I think, for filmmakers to see, and it's a great film for any artist to see, and definitely any lovers of film. So I did, though, get a chance to talk to Danny Houston about playing this role and what it was like for him and working with such a phenomenal cast. I'm here with Danny Houston.
Hello.
How are you? My first question is, when did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Well, really, you know, my childhood was full of great storytellers, and this is really something that belongs, I think, to my makeup. So somewhat dinners, lunches with people telling great stories at a time when really people didn't interrupt that much. They just sat back and they listened. Also, growing up in Ireland, where, you know, weaving a yarn, telling a tall tale was part of life. And evenings, not really any television, but really finding a good placement where maybe the candle lights sort of flickered and you could also cast shadows on the wall, and the shadows would be part of how you told a story and how you impressed upon your listeners. And late at night, sometimes this projector would come out and there would be a lot of talk about whether the projector would work or not, and old films sort of laced. And these films would be screened, sort of glorious sort of family albums, and films like Treasure of the Sierra Madre came up on the wall, and that's how I got to know my grandfather. I never actually met him physically. I met him through these stories. So it was just really part of growing up. And I mean, I approach acting as a storyteller, really. It's all I'm trying to do is impress something that may interest you.
All right, so as a storyteller, playing a storyteller, tell me a little bit about the research you did to play this character.
Well, you know, what I wanted to bring to it really was a sort of breeziness, not too much gravity. He was a writer, but maybe not a great one. He played it safe, possibly a bit of a hack, and somebody that was around Hitchcock and knew that he was around a true genius, and that he possibly wasn't true genius. In the way that Hitchcock is reckless, trying to get Psycho put together, Whitfield is the opposite. And in a way, in that sense, he kind of becomes Hitchcock's a nemesis. But he almost belongs to a character in one of Hitchcock's films. But there is an affection. It's a true affection that he has with Alma, which apparently existed. I wanted to create an air of romance as well. Maybe not with a great deal of depth, but romantic nevertheless. They want to go to the El Floridito, wherever it was, to have a juicy steak and drink some wine, you know? There's a lightness to Whitfield. While Hitchcock is going through all this inner turbulence, you probably want to spend an afternoon with Whitfield just to get out of there. So I don't want it to be superficial in any way, because his affections are real. I don't want to let that down as far as the character's concerned. But he's no great talent.
He seemed like he had an agenda. Now, do you feel his agenda was leaning more towards what he wanted for his career or for his heart?
I think his heart is in the right place, in the sense that he really does believe that there are certain things that he should do or should not do to have a good career. I think you could apply that to a lot of people that are trying to play it safe, that are not being reckless because they want a career. I think he's somebody who won't take that chance that sometimes you need to do to be creative. What's so wonderful about Hitchcock is that even at that point in his career, he wasn't stagnating. He was doing stuff that people didn't necessarily want him to do or didn't understand why he wanted to do them. Horror movies being regarded as sort of vulgar forms of filmmaking, that he actually did the first horror movie that was considered in a sort of a highbrow kind of way as important, and now sort of lives within our subconscious. That's in a way what Field lacks. And myself, as Danny Houston, having the opportunity of working with Helen Mirren and Anthony Hopkins, and what greater honor. One of the funny moments I remember was actually being in the shower with Helen Mirren, which was delightful in every way, and then hearing the metal against metal as the shower curtain opened, and revealing Hopkins as Hitchcock with a dagger in hand, and I just couldn't stop laughing. I was like, no, this is just all too good to be true, to be sandwiched in between Hopkins and Mirren.
Tell me a little bit more about working with Helen Mirren.
She's just so such a delightful person, so sweet, giving, sexy, gorgeous. And Sasha, the director, was very giving in the sense that he just let us play the scenes out, and with this sort of breeziness, I suppose, lightness that I was trying to bring with Whitfield's character. But we had a lot of space. There was never any sense or feeling that he wanted us to work within certain parameters. And we actually, at one point, while we were doing the scene, just both looked up and actually a whale came by, and wow. We looked at him, and went, wow, look at that, there's a whale. And we stayed in character, and off the whale went, you know, wherever it was headed. So those kind of, I wouldn't call that a small accident, rather large, I suppose, gifts were given to us, and we allowed them to be.
you're listening to now is from The Score by Danny Elfman. I'll play a few tracks before we go to our next film. And yes, before we go too far into the show, yes, I do have giveaways. And yes, it is Star Trek. How can I have a Star Trek giveaway? A movie giveaway? Here's the deal. As you may or may not know, they're releasing, now that they've done the original series, where they fix the effects and they put it on Blu-ray and remastered it digitally and fixed the sound and everything, they're doing the same thing with Next Generation. The first season is already out. It looks fantastic. They really did. They took all the digital elements and remastered them, and it just looks fantastic. But they're doing the same thing with, going to be for every season, but the second season's about to come out. But what they've done, Paramount, that is they're going to have a special event, and this is from Fathom Events, where they're going to have a special one-night presentation of Star Trek The Generation, a celebration of Season 2, playing two of the best episodes, Q-Who and The Measure of a Man. And Measure of a Man will have 11 minutes of footage that was cut out of the series at the time. And they're going to be showing this on the big screen for one night. So now that you're listening here to Night Shift, I can tell you I am giving away tickets for theaters all over the tri-state area. So here's the deal, whether you live in... Now pay attention. I have passes for Westbury. If you live in Westbury, put Star Trek Westbury. I have passes for Secaucus, New Jersey. I have four passes for Secaucus, New Jersey. So two people from Secaucus can email me and get two pairs. I have more for Westbury. So that's four pairs for Westbury. I have New Rochelle. I have Flushing. I have more Flushing. Wow, I actually have six pairs for Flushing. So three people can write me for Flushing. And I have for Manhattan, I have for the Empire 25 and Union Square. So send me an email. One is, all right, let me tell you what to put in the heading. Put Star Trek screening. And then put the town you're in. Because I will pick. I have multiple pairs for all the different theaters I told you. Westbury, Union Square, Empire 25 in New York. I have College Point Flushing. I have six pairs for College Point Flushing. New Rochelle, Kips Bay in New York, Westbury, and Secaucus. So if you want tickets to go see Star Trek, including New York, including Manhattan, go see Star Trek on the big screen. And I'll share this. When Star Trek Next Generation was on, I saw the first episode, and then I watched another. I never watched another episode after that. It was on for 7 years. And then just before the films came out, you know, they're going to have this movie. It's going to have something to do with the TV series. So I actually went to the Museum of Television and Radio that summer, was showing all the classic Star Trek The Next Generation episodes. So I was able to catch up on everything, the Borg and Worf's brother and all, and the Q and all these things that I really only knew a little bit of because everybody I knew was into Star Trek The Next Generation, of course. So I really didn't get to see it in its original run. But I got the pleasure of seeing it on the big screen there. And I have to say, what a great thing that was for me. Most of my experience of seeing Star Trek The Next Generation is on the big screen. So I'm pretty excited about seeing it on the big screen myself. Now it's been digitally remastered, better effects, sound, blah, blah, blah. So it's going to be Thursday, November 29th at 7 p.m., one night only, two episodes back to back. 13 minutes, actually, of never-before-seen additional content for Measure of Man and Q-Who. So the email, lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com. That's lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com. Just put Star Trek screening and just put the city you're in, and I'll let you know where the theater is. I'll send you the ticket, of course, if you win. But I'd say do that. lifeislikesciencefiction@gmail.com. Star Trek, Next Generation, big screen. Be there. Aloha. There are a number of films in theaters, or that just came in theaters this past Friday, and there are a few that are in theaters now that I can talk about. First film I'm going to talk about, of course, is Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2. I wasn't a huge fan of the Twilight series. I never read the books, and of course, I'm not a young or teenage girl, but I appreciated the notion of vampires and werewolves, not unlike another unnamed series of vampires versus werewolves. I always like that notion. I like the idea. I like the concept that they're among us, that they fight with each other, that they have different powers, and there's different lore. And, you know, I'm as open as anybody to a genre film. I thought the first Twilight film was almost laughable. It seemed like a big made-for-TV movie for me. I thought the second film was better. I thought the third film was even better than that. Fourth film, I thought it was a little bit of padding there. I thought they were really stretching it out to make it two parts. But this film, again, it's still got some of the flaws of the original, where it's at times may seem a little forced or a little soapy. But once you get into it and you know who these characters are and you appreciate what it is, maybe you can appreciate Twilight. This one, I think, is probably going to be considered one of the best. It definitely has some great sequences in it. And it definitely, at this point, has one of the best sequences. It has got a great fight sequence and a few twists. It has a great twist in the plot that takes everybody by surprise. And you've probably heard about it. If you haven't, don't ask. I say just go see it. Twilight Breaking Dawn Part 2. Actually, seeing what they do, this twist, is almost worth the price of admission on its own. And after a while, you pretty much just get used to these characters are these characters. And I think they've got them pretty much down by now. The other film that I'll mention that's out in theaters now is Lincoln, which is Steven Spielberg's epic about the life of Lincoln and most specifically the point leading up to him trying to pass in Congress freeing of the slaves. After the Emancipation Proclamation, which allowed them to fight, he had to go further to actually free them from bondage, much to the chagrin of many slave owners, because for them, they're losing money, they're losing their livelihood, they're losing a lot of things. And for Congress, there are a lot of issues. It's not just money, it's not just race, it's not just the racism of feeling that blacks are inferior. There are a lot of other political things going on. What this movie highlights is Lincoln's political genius. How he was able to manipulate the politics of the time to do something that was groundbreaking. At the same time, it was during the year that he most famously aged 10 years in that one year. A lot of pressure on this man. Daniel Day-Lewis is Lincoln. It's pretty remarkable. He looks just like him. You completely buy him as Lincoln. I will say this, though, however, having seen John Adams, which is the great HBO miniseries, seeing this at its best gets almost as good as that. Costumes are great, production design is good. But having seen it, having spent so much time in that world as I did watching John Adams, I'm not as impressed with this. I think it's good. I think it's very well done. Score by John Williams, which you're listening to a little bit of in the background, of course, is good. Tommy Lee Jones is probably going to get nominated for an Oscar for his turn as an abolitionist in the film. And there are a number of people who give some very, very memorable performances. It's a good movie, a solid movie. And the screenplay is by a former collaborator with Spielberg who wrote the screenplay for Munich, another somewhat underrated Spielberg film that I liked a lot. Lincoln's in theaters now. Definitely something worth seeing. Definitely something to bring your kids to. If they're in history class, it'll help. Next, another interesting film that's come out. Parker Posey has a film called Price Check. I was never a huge fan of Parker Posey, but I did appreciate what she's been able to contribute to film history, the kind of character she plays, the kind of quirkiness, what she brings to the table. Price Check is an interesting film. It's about a woman who's brought in to kind of turn around a company that is failing. And it's sort of a Walmart-type company. And she ends up having an affair. If you've seen any of the trailers, you know all this. An affair with someone high up in the organization. And, of course, madcap hilarity ensues. I found a lot of the laughs somewhat forced, or the humor, I should say, somewhat forced. Parker Posey, for me, can be a bit grating. So I'm not a fan. This is a movie I say you can wait to catch on DVD. If you're a Parker Posey fan. If not, you probably want to skip it completely. Another film that's coming out this Friday is a film called The Silver Linings Playbook, which is by David O. Russell. Now, David O. Russell is probably most famously known for not just his films like Three Kings and a number of other films he's done with dysfunctional characters, dysfunctional family, but he's also known for some pretty well-known bombs that had great actors like I Heart Huckabees. But he's probably best well-known for flipping out on set and it being captured on video and making the rounds at YouTube and going viral. So he's clearly a man who's got some issues. And he's very good at creating characters who have issues. And that's what he's done here with this film, The Silver Linings Playbook. Bradley Cooper plays the title character, or the main character. And he really shows a side of himself we haven't seen before. And what's interesting, we've all seen the neurotic guy get the neurotic girl. And two neurotic characters who are more or less made for each other. But it's very interesting to see these two actors, because Bradley Cooper, who is known for comedy and films like The Hangover and a film I really liked, Limitless, has a lot of range. he has a lot more range than you might think. And he really shows. And by having someone who's not so nebbishy, like a Woody Allen or a Ben Stiller, who normally play these type of nebbishy characters who are weird, quirky, but still good-looking or charming enough to get women, it's very interesting to see him play it. He plays it with an edge. He plays it with a seriousness. Though he's funny, and though he's clearly neurotic, and in this case, he's bipolar, some may be disturbed by the message that love can conquer anything, even if you're bipolar, and you can just find and be happy and be in love, and if you're bipolar. I don't think that's necessarily the message of the film. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it very much, much more than I thought I would. And Jennifer Lawrence also is a surprise. Her work in this film will, in some ways, I think, remind you of what you've been seeing out of Anne Hathaway. And she is someone who you might dismiss, as many have, the lead actress in the Twilight series, as just someone who got lucky for what she's done in The Hunger Games. But she's got chops, and what you saw from Winter's Bone was no fluke. She's an actress who has a lot of depth, and for her to play sort of this crazy character, she does it with an edge. So you've got two characters who really have the acting chops to really bring these characters to life. And David O. Russell, who's really pretty much a brilliant director. So Silver Linings Playbook is probably going to get nominated for a few things. And if you like the quirky romance, then it's definitely your cup of tea. It's definitely something I think you should go and see. Another film that also just came out this past Friday, coming out in theaters, is a really interesting, bold, visionary, beautiful film called The Life of Pi. It's directed by Ang Lee. Life of Pi centers around a character who is in a shipwreck, and only he is the only human to survive, and a tiger, and they are at sea for many weeks. I don't want to give away too much of the plot, but it's a pretty fantastic story. A number of somewhat fantastical things happen, and it's all told in past tense, because we meet the adult character, and he's being interviewed, and so he narrates this story as we're going through it. Life of Pi is about a lot of things. It is not just about the relationship between man and beast, in this case. It is not just a survival film. It is not just a reaffirmation of the human spirit. It is a film about storytelling. And as such, I got a chance to talk with David McGee, who is the screenwriter for Life of Pi, about adapting a story like this and about storytelling in general. Screenwriter of Life of Pi.
Hi there, how you doing?
When did you first know you wanted to be a storyteller?
Wow, that's an interesting question, and that's one that no one's asked me. I wanted to be in theater and the arts almost from the beginning. When I was 4 years old, my dad used to do community theater, and I went to see him rehearse in a play, and they had a kitchen scene, and I was not following the story at all at that point, but they turned on the faucet on the kitchen sink, And the water didn't come out. And I turned to my mom and I said, there's no water in the sink. And she said, there will be opening night. And I remember that to this day. We went backstage afterwards, and they showed me how they had hooked up a big bucket with a hose to the back of it and how they would run the water. And I was amazed that they would go to this clever trouble to create the illusion of reality. And I was fascinated by it. So I was an actor for years, and I wanted to direct, and I was fascinated by all of it. I went through school to study all of it, and it's really been what I've always wanted.
To you, what makes a good story and a story worth telling?
Wow, you hit me with the hard questions. What makes a good story is that it's not just a series of events that happen to people. It's that those events tell us something about their humanity, about what they're going through, and about how they change as a person as a result of those events. How's that?
That's a damn good answer. All right.
Thank you very much.
Tell me how you came to be connected with Life of Pi and a little bit about your journey to ending up being a screenwriter.
Sure. Well, I first read the book of Life of Pi 8 years ago or so when I was on the set of Finding Neverland. While they were filming, I was just passing time and someone had recommended the book and I loved it. And I went to the director, Mark Forster, the next day and I said, hey, there's a really good book. You ought to read this. I really enjoyed it. And he said, is it a film? And I said, no, I don't think so. Because it was too hard to make. I couldn't imagine a boy and a tiger on a boat in the water and how you keep the audience engaged for all that length of time. So I sort of dismissed it at that point as a wonderful book that probably wouldn't translate as a film. And then 3.5, 4 years ago, my agent called me one day and said, have you ever read the book Life of Pi? And I said, yes, I have. It's a very good book, but I got to tell you, it's a challenge. He said, well, Ang Lee is interested in directing it and wanted to know if you'd be interested in writing it. And I said, absolutely. If he was on board, I knew that it was going to be an interesting journey no matter what.
Sure.
So the next night, I went out to dinner with Ang, went to a sushi place in downtown Manhattan, and we talked about the book and the major themes, and we seemed to be on the same page with all of it. We agreed to go forward from there. He said, let's do it. And so that was it, and we launched right into it.
So what was the most rewarding and the most challenging part of doing this?
The most rewarding part and the most challenging part. I think, in terms of challenge first, finding the right tone for telling this story and finding the ways to tell Pi's story through actions so that we understand what he's going through emotionally on that journey without constantly turning to the audience and saying, well, now, and this is difficult, but I'll feel stronger as a result. You know, we needed to act in ways of telling that story so that you were riding along with it. In terms of the most rewarding, that's almost the hardest question you've asked so far, because so much of it has been rewarding. Mm. Working with Ang has been an absolute joy and pleasure, and I learned more about my craft on this film than on anything I've ever worked on. Taking the journey to India, going to Taiwan and watching a production that began with just two people sitting in his loft talking about ideas to hundreds and hundreds of people building sets and wave tanks being built in the middle of airfields and airplane hangars being turned into set building places. It was astounding. And just the fact that it all worked in the end, I'm very proud of this film. That's probably the most rewarding part of it. I'm very proud to have been a part of this, and I'm very proud to see how it's come out.
I kind of feel that your art defines you as you define your art.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to ask you, what did you learn about yourself in the process of making this film?
I think I realized that the same themes come back up in my writing and again. Fantasy versus reality. Telling. Facing mortality. Those were all themes in Finding Neverland, certainly. And Miss Pettigrew. Those were what attracted me to it. And while I thought, and I think, I have told a very different story with Life of Pi, I see those same themes coming up again and again. It gives you insight into what your preoccupations are and how you see yourself when you look back at your work and go, wow, I said that again, didn't I? But it's a surprise.
Yeah, sure, sure.
It's certainly not something that you set out, or at least I didn't set out consciously to do. I think it might have been Tennessee Williams who said, you know, everyone has like one story they tell over and over again, but I could be wrong on who said that. But I felt it when I looked back at what we created with this, that it was all different aspects of the same preoccupations that I have.
The transformative nature of embracing things you may reject.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something, another theme I see in your work.
Absolutely.
And I'm just curious for you, from what you've told me about your life story,
yeah,
that was a turning point for you to embrace something that you had put aside, mm-hmm, to realize, well, you know, I am a writer.
Absolutely. Well, I can tell you another story about embracing something that I think is kind of plays into that too, and that is when I was writing Finding Neverland, I was 34 or 35, I don't remember exactly, and I guess I was 35, and my father was dying of cancer. He had been ill for a long time, and my first son was about to be born. And I had spent the last decade and a half making no money as an actor and being a kid, not growing up. And Neverland, the theme of Neverland, I guess obviously, is growing up. What does it mean to grow up? And what does it mean to hold on to that childlike spirit and the fantasy and the wonder of the world, while at the same time embracing the reality of your life and becoming responsible for other people in the course of that. So that was very much what that journey was about. And I think Pi undergoes a similar journey in this film, where he is looking at his own ordeals and his own age from those two different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. What were the themes and elements that you...
Well, Mike Sargent's defective CD theater will resume or not, depending on whether it works in the other machine, which will take some time to accomplish. So, in the meantime, enjoy these wonderful promotional announcements.
The Secret City is an Obie Award-winning monthly gathering for artists and people who love the arts. Part salon, part cabaret, part tent revival, The Secret City has a different theme every month and features guest artists as well as live music, visual art, food offering, storytelling, community, and joy. We typically meet the last Sunday of the month at 11:30 a.m. at Dixon Place on the Lower East Side. All are welcome. Donations are accepted. We also provide free childcare. For more information and to read all about us, please visit our website at www.thesecretcity.org. Hope to see you there.
On the Tuesday, November 27th episode of Ecologic, my guest will be meteorologist Tom Weissmuller. For the past 3 years, he has accurately predicted how wet and cold the winter and spring will be and explains how the polar ice cap melting affects it. And he's going to do it again. And of course, we'll talk about Hurricane Sandy. That's Tuesday, November 27th at 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Gee, I could have sworn I punched up more than that. All right, well, in a 3-2-1, we're going to take it to 10 minutes before the end of this program. Because that's all the time we have for it. I'm sorry for the missing portion, but hey, I can time manage. Other people can't.
No, Dennis.
This is WBAI New York.
At one point, we were trying to get Doc John Denver, and I think the cost of taking home Country Road by Doc John Denver was going to be $1 million or something, or $500,000, which is, needless to say, prohibitively expensive for us. Yeah, that created one challenge, was finding well-known dead musicians who we could afford their music. And then the Britpop, there's a couple of tracks when he goes to this nightclub where there's a special Britpop night, and he's kind of the guest of honor unofficially, where we got some songs. But yeah, it was difficult. You know, it's not easy to get an Oasis song. It's easy to get Bittersweet Symphony by The Verve. We had to get creative, and we had an incredible music supervisor named Joe Rudge, who's done also Beasts of the Southern Wild and Time and a lot of other films. He was just amazing, and I think he really enjoyed the challenge that we put to him as a music fan. You know, it was a great movie, I think, to work on as a music lover. And then, of course, we had two original songs in the film as well that we wrote specifically for the movie, which was also a fun challenge.
I tend to believe that a film is directed three times. First time in your head when you're writing it, you're directing it. Second time when you're on the set, and third time when you're in the editing room where you can craft things that may or may not even be there. A, do you agree with that? And B, what's your favorite stage, or what do you get out of each stage?
I do agree with that. I can definitely tell you that at this point in my life, the least favorite stage is writing. I really like being on set. The things I like about directing is that by the time the shoot is done, you're really ready to get in the editing room. By the time you're finished writing, you're really ready to get on set. By the time you're finished on set, you're really ready to get in the editing room and just be sitting in the quiet with one or two other people and really sift through what you have. And they're all important. And, you know, it is true. I think the movie starts to tell you what the story is. And another thing you'll hear a lot is that the problems you have in the script are the same problems you're going to have when you're done, when you're editing and trying to get that to work. And I found that to be true, too.
What kind of response have you been getting from audiences that you've actually shown the film for?
We've been getting really great responses and really varied responses as far as what they connect in the movie. I mean, that's one of the things about it that's really interesting, because it has so many different strands to it. Some people are really taken with the music, and it's been really gratifying to show it to musicians who feel connected to it in some way, who feel like it resonates with them. Some people are really interested in the immigration bureaucracy aspect of it. Many, many people are really taken with Robert Carlyle's performance, which I am too. So it's been fun to show it around. Been privileged. We premiered at the Sundance Film Festival last January, and since then have played at film festivals around the country and around the world. So it's been a wide variety of responses. We haven't even talked about it, but, you know, a lot of the film is also about alcoholism is a big part of it. And there's a great, I went to film school with a filmmaker named James Ponsold, who has a movie out called Smashed, which is also at Sundance and deals even more directly with this issue. And I thought that was a great film. Mine, nobody ever uses the word alcoholism or really talks about it, but it's definitely a big part of it. And the very first question at the very first screening at Sundance, the first time I ever showed it to an audience, 1,300 people in the theater, and the very first question was from somebody who said that they had had experience with this, and that in a way it was sort of hard to watch this because it was so true and powerful for them. And having not put a word about it in there, that was really gratifying to me that was able to come through.
What was the most challenging and the most rewarding part of this project for you?
Making a movie on a low budget is always presents its challenges. But within that, I guess it's also the most rewarding part was we were able to make this movie and work, you know, all the people who I worked with on it, the producer, the cinematographer, all the actors, everybody's, you know, when it comes to a movie like this, we're all in it together and we're all working to make the same movie. So it's been mostly, I get the biggest thrill out of the people who were involved with the movie being excited about it. That's the best part at the moment.
What's next? Do you have something that you're working on right now?
I'm working on another couple of movies with him. It's a thriller called Exodus. It's set in the Caribbean that we're shooting early next year. And I'm writing the screenplay for an adaptation of a graphic novel that was out a few years ago called The Imposter's Daughter by Laurie Sandell, about a true story about a journalist who goes to write an article about her very impressive father and discovers that he's a con artist and a fraud and has lied about everything he ever told her.
Is there a website for the film?
There is. It's www.californiasolo.com. We have a Facebook page as well. Twitter is at California Solo. Both will have a lot of information about theaters that we're opening at, cities, and press links and things like that.
And when does it open in New York?
It opens November 30th.
Well, Marshall, I look forward to hopefully talk to you again. Exodus sounds interesting, and this adaptation sounds really good, too.
Thank you. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking to you.
All right, well, good luck, man.
Thanks. Thanks very much.
The film is called California Solo. It opens up this Friday. Again, a very interesting study of, you know, rocker past his prime. Interesting place he is. It's really his brother who was the famous one, and the brother died, and now he's just sort of adrift. But definitely worth seeing. And that was Marshall Louis, who's the writer-director. This has been Night Shift. I'm Mike Sargent, and you can like us on Facebook, N-I-T-E-S-H-I-F-T. You can, we have a Twitter. You can sign on to our Twitter account, N-I-T-E-S-H-I-F-T-Z. And you can stay tuned and be part of Night Shift. And remember, if you want those tickets, Star Trek, tell us the place you want to be. LifeIsLikeScienceFiction@gmail.com. That's right, Star Trek in Westbury, Star Trek in New Rochelle this Thursday. Don't forget. Until next time, this is Night Shift.